Welcome to 1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion. Each month, our hosts, Casey, Derek, and Scott, take a look at the film catalogue of the legendary Hammer Films production, one picture at a time. Covering everything from the famous Hammer Gothic horror films, to their science fiction films, their thrillers, their film noirs, and comedies, this podcast will offer critical opinion, production notes, and historical facts about the films that make Hammer great. Make yourself comfortable, have a cup of tea, and welcome to 1951 Down Place.
Hello and welcome to this episode of 1951 Down Place, the monthly Hammer Films podcast produced by me and my friends, Casey and Scott. I'm Derek. I want to welcome you to this episode. I believe it's episode number 55, and we're going to be talking about the 1960 film, The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. This is directed by one of our favorites, Terrence Fisher, and we're going to get into this film here in a moment. Before we do that, though, I wanted to take a moment and just recognize the passing of somebody whose voice has been part of the classic B-movie podcasting community for 10 years. I'm talking about Vince Rotolo, the man behind the B-movie cast. Vince, unfortunately, passed away unexpectedly this past week, and his absence will definitely be felt in the podosphere in general, and just the fandom, the community that built up around the B-movie cast and these kinds of movies. I considered Vince a friend, and I was fortunate enough to appear on a handful of episodes at the B-movie cast, and I even had a chance to talk about some Hammer films several years ago over there. I know I talked about The Revenge of Frankenstein, Vampire Circus, and Night Creatures were all movies that I had a chance to discuss with Vince and the gang over there. That was always fun to be part of the show, but it was even more fun to listen to the show and just listen to Vince and his interactions with Mary specifically. Of course, Nick and Juan were part of the show as well. And, you know, Vince is going to be missed. I don't know what's going to happen to the B-movie cast. Nobody said anything, and really, in terms of priority, well, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and that's fine. You know what? For 374-plus episodes, and actually, I believe there's probably closer to, I'm going to say maybe up to 400, because there were always a number of spin-off shows and little bits here and there that he did along the way. Almost 400 episodes of B-movie cast goodness to go back to and listen to. Go over to bmoviecast.com. Check out the archives. Go to bmoviecast.com/tag/hammer-films to find those three Hammer episodes that I did with Vince. There are other Hammer film episodes as well, with people like Adrian from the UK joining. You know, I'm going to miss him. And I know a lot of listeners are going to miss what Vince brought to the table. Because the B-movie cast was typically released on a Sunday afternoon, we're choosing to release this episode of 1951 Down Place on Sunday as well. Normally we try to get it at the end of the month, but, you know, May 1st is Sunday, so we're going to try to put it out today in honor of the B-movie cast. Also, coincidentally, the movie they were going to cover over the B-movie cast today was a Hammer film, Dracula AD 1972, which actually is one of my favorites. I really, really enjoy the final two Christopher Lee Dracula films from Hammer. For right or wrong, I love them. And I was really looking forward to Vince and the gang tackling this one. I know we'll eventually cover it here on 1951 Down Place down the line, but it would have been nice to hear what they had to say. I'm going to be doing a tribute to Vince on my own podcast, Monster Kid Radio, which will be going out here in a couple of days. Even though there's a really short period of time here, I want to open this up. If anybody has any comments or thoughts that they'd like to share regarding Vince Rotolo on the B-movie cast, and you want to share that over at Monster Kid Radio, because that episode's coming out on Tuesday, please do not hesitate to email me your remembrances of Vince at monsterkidradio@gmail.com. You can also email an audio file over there, or if you just want to use our voicemail line, we've got a 3-minute limit. It's Google. You can always call us at 503-479-5657. That's 503-479-5MKR. There is a 3-minute limit on that voicemail line. Now, I am putting that episode out on Tuesday, which means you've basically got a day to get something to me. I know, short notice here, but I have been talking about it on Facebook pretty much ever since Vince passed. Now, this episode was recorded much earlier in the month of April, before all of this happened, so we don't comment on it in the conversation or anything like that. None of us knew it was coming, so it doesn't come up. What does come up is our conversation about the movie Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, and we're going to get to all of that right after this.
Yesterday, Dracula was the most fearsome being the screen has ever seen. Today, tonight, you could be Dracula's next victim.
Something new, yet as old as time.
Come on, Johnny.
A date with the devil.
Are you ready? He's ready. He's waiting to freak you out. Right out of this world.
Died September the 18th, 1872. 100 years ago to the day.
You who witness it must swear before the name of the devil to keep it secret.
Who knows about vampires, for God's sake?
My grandfather died fighting a vampire. The most terrible, the most dangerous vampire of all time.
The year is 1972. A leap year in horror. A vintage year for vampires. The masters of horror to meet again in the 20th century.
Come to me, come Dracula!
The nightmare's over.
I don't think it is.
I have returned to destroy it. You!
C-3PO.
Loki.
Mace Windu.
Dr. Bruce Banner.
Captain Rex.
Venom.
Princess Leia.
Jean Grey.
Darth Maul.
Nick Fury.
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Captain America.
Lando Calrissian.
Cyclops.
What do all these characters have in common?
Well, two of them were played by Samuel L. Jackson.
A couple of them were played by Hammer Films veterans Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
Come on, guys. You know this.
Well, of course we do, Jessica. Just like Mickey Mouse and Captain Jack Sparrow, they're all now Disney characters. Hello, I'm Tracy of the Disney Indiana podcast, and my co-host Scott and I enjoy talking about all aspects of the House of Mouse, and that includes their newest properties, Marvel and LucasArts.
We also talk about Disney resorts, the cruise line, theme parks, and whatever else Mickey has to offer.
Which includes movies, Imagineering, video games, and collectibles. You'll never know what we'll decide to talk about.
So check us out at www.disneyindiana.com or do a search for the Disney Indiana podcast on iTunes, because now we've got a lot more to talk about.
And don't forget about those other quote-unquote Disney characters like, well, Sully.
Fozzie Bear.
Buzz Lightyear.
Link Hogthrob.
Doug.
Janice.
Merida.
Pepe.
Bruce.
Ralph the Dog.
Wally.
Dr.
The Disney
Bunsen
Indiana
Honeydew.
Podcast. Syndrome. Even after 5 years, we are still miles away from the nearest Main Street, USA. We're not listed on the map, but you can join us at www.disneyindiana.com.
This is the Count, and I welcome you to 1951 Down Place, your home for Hammer Films discussion. I must apologize for not being here to greet you personally, but I trust you found everything you needed. If you need anything, my servants Casey, Derek, or Scott can assist. Thank you.
Well, 1960 Hammer Films is still pumping out horror movies, like a movie called Jekyll's Inferno. The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, directed by our favorite director, or at least one of them, Terrence Fisher. And I'm joined by my favorite podcast, or at least two of them, Scott Morris from Disney Indiana and Casey Criswell from, well, 1,000 Podcasts, Bloody Good Horror, and who knows what else he's doing this week.
You could say it's the two faces of podcasting.
Oh, boy. Where does that leave me? Can I be the Christopher Lee?
Sure.
All I want to know is this guy a Batman villain?
How long have you been sitting on that?
All week.
Yeah.
Not long enough, obviously.
So, Derek, if the two faces of podcasting makes you Christopher Lee, does that make Scott Kitty?
You've been playing that hard since yesterday. So, okay, listeners, Casey and Scott and I, we're in contact with each other when we're not recording. I mean, we're friends on Facebook, we're friends outside of here, whatever. Scott sends me these voice messages, and we'll get to that here in a second. Casey starts going off about how Scott's going to do the can-can during the show.
It was a simple bet for $5 if Scott wore his can-can dress to the recording.
I've got my can-can dress on and my granny panties.
Ooh, I'll PayPal you $6 for the granny panties.
Well, this show went downhill real fast. I blame Jekyll. I blame Hammer. I blame Wolf Mankiewicz.
Wolf Mankiewicz.
What was that?
Wolf Mankiewicz would be our screenwriter, but, you know, it's more entertaining just because of the name.
Listen to Casey all starting to sound serious for a second.
Yeah, well, somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, Wolf was known more for being a playwright, did a lot of stage work, that sort of thing, and he was brought into Hammer to do this. Didn't do a lot more for Hammer, if anything else, actually. Now that I'm looking at his credit list, it doesn't look like he did much at all for Hammer. He did a lot of TV. He's probably going to be one of Scott's connections, but I don't want to...
You think?
...steal his thunder. Wow, are we just going to dive right into this thing? The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll? Why not? Okay. I'm glad I could ask that and answer myself. Terrence Fisher, we like him quite a bit. Hammer's chugging along, putting these horror movies out. Fisher is their guy, their go-to guy. He's not the only one doing it, obviously, but he's their go-to guy. We love him from the work he did on the Frankenstein and the Dracula films. So let's give him Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. Let's do it. Why not, right?
Sure, why not?
It did. You know what? We'll get there. We'll get there. Let's talk a little bit about the pre-production maybe, yeah?
Okay.
Sure.
All right. So they want to do a Jekyll and Hyde film. And this is not the only time Hammer did Jekyll and Hyde, for the record. I believe they did two others, didn't they?
This is their third one, I believe.
Everyone knows there are two sides to the infamous Dr. Jekyll. By day, the man. By night, the monster.
Put a woman in your life. A good woman. And one day you'll wake up and you'll see a changed man.
Now, Hammer believe you too are ready for a change. An absolutely complete change.
This is the testament of Dr. Henry Jekyll. Male. Male. Male.
It's Hyde, isn't it? How is your brother?
He hasn't been himself of late.
This is the new Dr. Jekyll, the most evil woman you'll ever see. This is the sensuous Sister Hyde, the most evil man you'll ever meet.
Stay away from her. She means you great harm.
Why?
I just... feel it, that's all.
Dr. Jekyll, Sister Hyde. Man or woman? Or both? In this film, you will actually see the sinister Dr. Jekyll change in mind and body into the totally evil Sister Hyde.
It is I who exist, Dr. Jekyll, not you. It is I who will be rid of you. Rid of you! Rid of you! Rid of you!
Hammer invites you to share the agony of a man whose body is possessed by a strange passion to murder and beyond.
They must be female, no more than 20 years old.
There will be a different kind of victim tonight. And then the tug of war will be ended between us.
So there's also Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, and then what was the other one?
House of Inferno.
House of Inferno.
Yes.
Okay. No, I want to see that movie. And you know, maybe before we started here, I should say, I personally don't have a lot of experience with Jekyll and Hyde stories. And maybe that's a good place to start here. What about you two?
I don't have much experience with them at all. Out of all the classic monster type of stories and whatnot, it's just one that never really connected with me.
And honestly, the only experience I had with this story outside, you know, what's known in the pop culture is The Nutty Professor.
I knew it. Which one?
Oh, the original.
Well, we're just about ready, Jennifer.
You might be ready, Julius, but if I were you, I'd think about it.
We don't care if you blab about the beginning of this picture, nor do we care if you give away the ending, but we do care if you reveal the middle. In fact, Jerry Lewis urges you to see this picture from the beginning on penalty of losing your popcorn privileges. One thing we will tell you is that Jerry plays the part of an eccentric chemistry professor who invents the greatest new drink since Dracula discovered the Bloody Mary. One sip and he turns into, that would be telling. And even those who know aren't telling. Professor?
Professor!
Professor, keep the mind on the chemistry.
Yeah, for me, when I was first getting into classic monsters and all that, I was all Universal all the way, and Jekyll and Hyde just wasn't really part of that canon, part of that cycle. Now, I've gone back and I've watched a handful of them. Although I tend to find myself enjoying the ones that are more ridiculous than serious, more than anything else, like Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde.
Bernie Casey is Dr. Black.
Hiya, Doc. No, you can't try that serum on a human.
A monster he could not control had taken over his very soul. A screaming demon rages inside, turning him into Mr. Hyde.
This is no nightmare, Doctor. You're real.
Super strong, supernatural, and super bad.
That's a cross between the abominable snowman and Willie the Werewolf.
Indestructible. Nothing can stop him. Not bombs, bullets, or bulldozers. No man alive could take that guy. But he's on his feet when he hits the street. Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde. His victim thinks she's tricked him, but she hasn't a prayer when he leaps through the air. Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead.
In a moment, you'll look like me.
Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde. Don't give him no sass or he'll kick your ass. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked. The bar flies are trying, but their bodies keep flying. The dude stood tall till his butt hit the wall. When the boys go rushing, Mr. Hyde starts crushing. The crowd is hushing as the blood comes gushing.
Don't just stand there like crushing dumb asses. Get him!
There's a heel behind the wheel when Hyde takes his ride. No man can survive when he shifts into drive. It ain't no jive trying to stay alive. Silky won't revive from his final nosedive.
Brother man, this situation is rapidly becoming insalubrious, meaning we're about to stomp a mud hole in your ass.
From the first verse to the last blast, it's Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde, starring Bernie Casey, Rosalind Cash, Stu Gillum, directed by William Blackyella Crane. Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
I like a lot, and probably for all the wrong reasons, and it makes me a terrible person. But I think when we say Jekyll and Hyde, we know exactly, pop culture-wise, we know what we're talking about. We're talking about Nutty Professor style stuff. We're talking about the Incredible Hulk style stuff. We're talking about the original Robert Louis Stevenson story, which I believe I read in grade school once. But beyond that, I don't have much Jekyll or Hyde in me.
I've never read it other than, like I said, just what's known in the pop culture and from cartoons. I think Bugs Bunny went up against him in a Bugs Bunny cartoon at one point.
Yeah.
That wasn't an Elmer Fudd as Hyde?
It might have been. It's been so long since I've seen it, but I do remember there being somebody that was drinking some sort of potion that would turn him into a monster.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, The Ugly Duckling. That was the other version that Hammer did. Which was a comedy approach to this, which is what The Nutty Professor would end up being 3 years later. So I found it interesting that The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, which does kind of reverse the roles, predates the Jerry Lewis take on the same thing.
And I would love to know if this film is an influence on that. If they took the ideas that are presented in this film, toned it down more for a family audience, and came out with The Nutty Professor.
Why would you have to tone it down, Scott?
I'll just say boa constrictor.
Yeah.
That's the only thing you need to say. This movie, it's dark, man. I mean, we're used to seeing vampires and werewolves and whatever. No big deal. We deal with that. They're monsters. Fine. This one, it gets kind of dark. And I know there were some concerns about the sex and the violence in the script. And they tried to tone it down as best as they could. But I feel like this one, especially for a 1960 Hammer, kind of goes a little far.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though, because it makes it darker because it's not like a monster-type situation.
It's a lot more psychological.
Yeah, because he actually looks more human once he makes his transformation. So, yeah, it's definitely a dark side of humanity-type situation. Whereas I'm familiar with what I'm familiar with the Dr. Jekyll's story is he's kind of normal, takes his potion, and then he, you know, becomes monster-like.
Well, I always thought he was not normal, but kind of meek and not very strong and wanted to be more stronger. So he was looking to become stronger and then turns him into this grotesque monster.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately the interesting bit about Jekyll and Hyde, at least from our limited experience, is that while Hyde does become the monster, there's still some qualities in Hyde that Jekyll wants or craves or is missing and that sort of thing. In this case, I feel like, yeah, it's a psychological kind of story, but they make it pretty clear that Jekyll and Hyde are a yin and a yang, two sides of the coin. I don't feel like Jekyll, once he realizes what Hyde is, craves those elements that Hyde brings to the table.
No, they set that up pretty early when they are talking about Dr. Jekyll's experiments and theories of everybody has two personalities. There's the one personality that sticks to the social norms and is polite in public and everything. And then there's the side, there's another personality that's in you that doesn't care what society thinks and just does what they want and acts on their base instincts. And that's what they're exploring in this film, not just a human and a monster. It's more psychological, how the brain works and how your emotions can control you or not control you.
And I'd like to read a passage. What the hell? I'd like to read now from the Holy... I'd like to read from the Hammer story by Marcus Hearn and Alan Barnes. Evil is attractive to all men, explained Mankiewicz, who is, as we discussed, the screenwriter. He was interviewed during production at Bray Studios. Therefore, it is not illogical that the face of evil should be attractive. That is why I made Mr. Hyde handsome instead of repulsive. This is not a horror film. It is a comment on the two-facedness of respectable society. My screenplay exposes the evil of the Victorians, tears from the mask of falseness and hypocrisy. It also contains some comment on the evil of scientific pride, divorced from both human and ethical considerations. And I think that's kind of what we're kind of dancing around a little bit here, is that this one really does not try to show the same person, the two sides of the same person, but definitely this evil wickedness, this hypocrisy. It's interesting to know that from the very beginning, they, or at least the screenwriter, had that in mind.
Yeah.
Why they gave that screenplay to Fisher, I have no idea, but...
Yeah, it's very obvious in the film that that's what they're going for. That's the impression that I got.
Well, there's even that very bit at the end where the police officer basically looks at the audience. Evil can never... I forget what he says, but it's pretty on point, very sermon-like.
The case of Dr. Jekyll is a solemn warning to us not to meddle with the divine pattern of nature.
At the very, very end, during the... is it during the... the court scene of the Inquisition? I don't know. There's this bit at the end, and it's just like, really?
Nobody suspects the Inquisition.
I thought you were going for a Spaceballs. Evil will always triumph because good is dumb.
Right? Yeah? Yeah? All right. So let's see. I've mentioned a few times Fisher. This was one of the movies that, was it when we did Kiss of the Vampire, when we talked a little bit about how Fisher was not approached to do that film because maybe this one didn't do as well for him? It was pretty recently we talked about that. But yeah, this one, Fisher ended up directing. I think it probably would have been better as a Val guest or maybe even I don't know. I don't know why he ended up directing. Wolf Mankiewicz is the screenwriter. We talked a little bit about him. He came from the stage. His full name is Cyril Wolf Mankiewicz, and he was given $5,000 to make this to write this screenplay, which I don't know why that is mentioned so much in this Hammer story book, other than maybe that was a lot of money at the time.
Could have been. It makes sense.
A hefty £5,000 for his story and screenplay. He was given a summer to write the thing. And my understanding is that as soon as they cast Paul Massey, 5 days later they were off and running and producing. And that might have been because he was a late addition, because they really wanted somebody else that they just couldn't afford. So they pinned this movie on Paul Massey's performance. He's kind of our lead. He plays both roles. And what's interesting is I did see a bit where, or I did read something or somewhere, where Paul Massey had to pitch to play both parts, which to me sounds like they were implying they were going to have another actor play Hyde or Jekyll, one or the other. And I wonder how that would have worked. I kind of like it with him playing both roles.
Yeah.
I actually liked his performance. I thought he was pretty good. I don't know why they're pinning it on him being a problem with it.
Oh, no. Don't misunderstand, please. I'm not saying that the critical reviews are saying it was his fault. I'm saying the movie itself hinges on him.
Oh, yeah.
I'll
agree
with that. We have to pin everything on him, because without him, it kind of just falls apart, and I still think it kind of does a little bit, but I'm getting ahead of myself. No, I thought he was fine. It's tough because Jekyll and Hyde, even though we don't have a lot of experience with Jekyll and Hyde, the pop culture certainly does. And this is something that's brought up in a few different books that I've read here. Specifically, I believe it's brought up in the Hammer Films, An Exhaustive Filmography by Tom Johnson and Deborah Delvecchio. Hi, Deborah. I know you're listening. that you're casting Paul Massey in a role that's made famous by people like Spencer Tracy. So you're up against some real heavy hitters, I guess, when it comes to acting. And you know, you cast this Canadian guy who hasn't done a heck of a lot. I don't know.
I enjoyed Paul Massey in this role a lot too. And for me, when you're casting, I've got to think that their angle was they're going for a different angle on the Dr. Jekyll transformation. So why not experiment and do something different?
Why not?
Yes.
You mentioned that Paul Massey wasn't their first choice. Their first choice was an actor by the name of Lawrence Harvey for this role.
Well, and speaking of people not getting what they want casting wise, Christopher Lee's in this movie and he wanted to play that role. I don't know how it would have worked with him in that role. We do get to see him do that in a movie called I, Monster in 1970 from Amicus.
First night in the age of horror.
Very well. I pleaded with you to let me leave in peace. But you refused. Now, look.
Thank you.
monster. Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing and Mike Raven add diabolical chills to the story of a man who made the trip to the other world once too often.
Mr. Blake?
Now for him, Earth is nothing more than a terror stop somewhere between hell and the other world.
What are you waiting for?
I, Monster. Recommended only if your veins can stand the cold torment of evil. Not storybook evil, but the evil you may face this very night. I, Monster. The other you. I, Monster. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Which is another take on the Jekyll and Hyde story. But I don't know if I could have seen Lee in this particular role, just because I'm always so used to seeing Lee as a villain, or in the case of this film, a really slimy guy. I don't know if he could have pulled off the suave.
I don't think there's anybody in this film that's good.
That's true.
But then again, if Christopher Lee would have been our main Jekyll and Hyde character, we would have lost that great scene of him being drunk.
Yeah.
Don't drink too much tonight, my darling.
Cunning little kitty cat. Rather a dull husband than a drunken lover.
Mr. Paul Allen, is it not?
Not if you're one of my bloody creditors.
Mr. Allen occasionally indulges himself in these pleasantries. Please excuse him.
What perfect manners.
Christopher Lee steals every scene he's in, and even a few he's not.
Yes, that the scene in the Sphinx Club, the first time that Hyde meets him and he's playing drunk, is just outstanding.
Every scene where at the club between the two of them, I love. And man, Christopher Lee ended up loving playing this character, even though he really wanted Jekyll to begin with. He talks about how sleazy and dirty and just low this guy is, and he even has to borrow money from his mistress, and that is like the lowest of the lows as far as he's concerned. It's just so, I don't want to use the word Casey used, but he had a nice word for Christopher Lee's performance in this yesterday when we were chatting on Facebook.
Am I supposed to drop that here?
I don't know.
I thought we'll go a little bit adult warning here, but I thought Christopher Lee was delightfully douchey in this movie.
Although he could have taken some chop growing lessons from Peter Cushing, I'm just saying.
Well, I thought he played a good user, a user of everybody.
Oh,
yeah.
Certainly.
Well, like Derek said it best, I mean, he was absolutely slimy. I mean, he was practically dripping or oozing. He was that slimy, and it was just really great. And that's why, too, when you hear he wanted that role of Dr. Jekyll, we would have missed out on that role. And I think that would have hindered this movie a lot if we didn't have Christopher Lee in the role that he had.
But you also needed somebody that looked good, because you had to be convinced that Kitty actually fell in love with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, true. You did have to have the looks and the charisma. Kitty being played by Dawn Adams, who did quite a bit. She did appear in at least one of their Hammer films, The Vampire Lovers, I believe.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's in The Vampire Lovers.
Hark, a film of tender love and the screams of vampire death. Now, there's a powerful motion picture that rips at your emotions. The Vampire Lovers. It brings you beautiful love and vampire evil, and it'll drive your mind through 1,000 terror-filled moments. You'll hear whispers of warm desire become shrieks of chilling death. You'll taste the deadly passion of the Vampire Lovers and become a slave of the damned. You'll discover the sweet embrace and the deadly kiss of blood nymphs who refuse to die. The Vampire Lovers. It's in color, and it had to be rated R. Under 17 must be accompanied by a parent or adult guardian. Don't miss The Vampire Lovers.
She's done quite a bit. She's in one of my favorite 1950s science fiction films called Riders to the Stars, which unfortunately doesn't have an official DVD release. But it's good if you ever get a chance to see it. I'm just saying. I did like her in this. And I like kind of the two-facedness, there we go back to that word that Wolf mentioned earlier. And it's so obvious that she has no interest whatsoever, and she's so brazen about it when it comes to her relationship with Jekyll. I mean, she even tries to play him up a little bit. You know, oh, it's a shame you didn't come out to dinner with me. If he had gone out to dinner with you, he would have seen you with Paul at the club. But I don't know, she's just so brazen. I kind of liked it.
Yeah,
it was crazy because they were so public with this affair.
Well, it's easy to do when your husband is a hermit and never leaves his laboratory.
That's true, but you'd think people in town would talk.
Yeah, but who are they going? He's never going to find out because he never leaves the lab to hear any of it.
True.
I mean, the only one that comes to see him is Ernst,
or in Paul when he wants money.
Yeah. Right, and Paul's not going to say anything.
True. Ernst, played by David Kossoff. Oh, what did you think of him? To me, he was the most likable guy in the movie.
he was the only one that was a good character in if you go with good versus evil. And he's got a small role. He's basically a friend of Dr. Jekyll's from when Jekyll was actually in the public, like at university or something, before he's drummed out of there, ridiculed out. And Ernst still goes and checks up on him every once in a while. But yeah, you're right. He's the only one that has any good in him in this film. Outside the mute kids.
Yeah.
But not even all of them are good, because when we first meet them, one pushes another one away.
Yep.
Is this Jekyll proving his point that we all have good and evil, even the mute kids or the dumb kids?
Yes. And it all comes out during their play.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. Let's see. We mentioned the snakes. Originally, there were some fake snakes used that are designed and built that ended up not being used. They were designed by Bernard Robinson's wife, which I thought was an interesting connection there. I don't know if Robinson himself did much with this film. It was not shot mostly. I mean, mostly it was shot at Elstree. Some of it was shot at Bray. Oh, and some of it was shot at Down Place.
Yay!
Oh, man. What? Anything else we want to comment on cast or crew-wise?
Well, I've got.
Do we have any connections?
Like I say, I've got quite a few more things to talk about in connections.
You know what? Wait a minute. Hold on a minute. What the hell is wrong with us? There's somebody in the cast we have to talk about briefly, because he's only in the movie briefly.
Mr. Reed?
Yeah. Hello.
I know.
It's his first Hammer film.
Really?
Yep. This is the first time he'd worked for Hammer.
And he's billed as Heavy.
Well, in the IMDb, he's called Tough.
Well, to be fair, I mean, he seems like he's pretty solidly built, so he probably is kind of heavy.
You'd have to be for all the booze, right?
Exactly.
I gotta ask you guys this. Is he a pimp in this movie?
He certainly feels like it, doesn't it?
I know. Yes.
There's a lot of that in this movie, though. That's just, okay, they went to a dancing club. Sure. Oh, wait a minute. Let's spend a few minutes there and just think about what really is happening here. Uh-huh. Yeah. I thought he was great.
Oh,
when
I did too.
Up on screen, I'm like, oh man, I had forgotten this was his feature or his Hammer debut, because he just felt right at home here.
And your eyes are, I mean, when he first shows up on the screen, you're looking right at him. I mean, he stands out so prominently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's commanding.
Doesn't last long, but no. he definitely pulls. He commands the camera. It's pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Definitely can see why he became, well, the icon really that he kind of is.
Yes.
And, yeah, just real brief to go back, Bernard Robinson did do the production design on this. Costume design by Mayo. That's her professional name. She's an Egyptian designer. The name stood out to me. Although when I look at her credit list, she did some movies like The Adulterist and Naughty Girl. So now I want to see more about what she's done.
I'm assuming that she did the Snake Lady's outfit.
Oh, I'm sure.
Such as Mayo.
Maria's outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take the stars from the sky and put them in the pocket? Such as Mayo.
What?
That's another SNL reference to Mango.
Oh, okay. You mentioned Maria. Norma Marla. She also appeared in The Ugly Duckling, which was the other... The first Hammer.
Well, Oliver take on this. And Oliver Reed appears in the other one in Dr. Jekyll, Dr. Jekyll's Sister Hyde.
Which I'm told it's the best of the three.
Well, isn't it Martine Bestwick?
She's Sister Hyde.
Exactly.
Birthday pick.
Scott, you've got connections, and I almost blew like two or three of them a second ago, so I'm ready.
Okay.
The James Casey, are you ready?
I'm always ready.
All right.
Well, I've heard that.
We'll start off with the James Bond connections. And to get the easy one out of the way, Christopher Lee, we've talked about him several times in the past, being the titular character in 74's The Man with the Golden Gun, and he's also the cousin to James Bond creator Ian Fleming.
Sorry, the James Bond corrector. That's the name of our Bond cast right there.
That would be M, wouldn't it? Next, we have Francis DeWolfe, who was the inspector in Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. He is also in 1963's From Russia with Love, playing Varvara, the head of a tribe of gypsies that live in the outskirts of Istanbul, Turkey. We also have Clifford Earle, an uncredited member of the Youngblood in Two Faces. He's also in 1971's Diamonds Are Forever as an immigration officer.
You ever get the impression, Casey, just between you and me, you ever get the impression it might just be easier for Scott to tell us who wasn't in a James Bond movie?
Yes.
I'm just wondering. You know?
Oliver Reed was not in a James Bond movie. But Walter Gothel was. He's listed as the second gambler in Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. He's appeared in several James Bond films. In 1963's From Russia with Love, he plays Morzeny, who ran Ernst Stavo Blofeld's training grounds on Spectre Island. In 1973, he returned in The Spy Who Loved Me as the head of the Russian KGB, General Gogol. And he would reprise that role in 79's Moonraker, 81's For Your Eyes Only, 83's Octopussy, 85's A View to a Kill, and 1987's The Living Daylights. Doug Robinson, one of the barefisted boxers that we see in the film, appeared in several James Bond films as both an actor and stuntman. He acted in 1985's A View to a Kill as a thug and was a stuntman in 67's You Only Live Twice, 71's Diamonds Are Forever, 74, The Man with the Golden Gun, 77's The Spy Who Loved Me, 81 For Your Eyes Only, 83 Never Say Never Again, 85's A View to a Kill, and 1987's Living Daylights. Joe Robinson, an uncredited Corinthian in Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, played Peter Franks in 1971's Diamonds Are Forever. Franks is an international diamond smuggler in the film. MI6 captures Franks and Bond assumes his identity to infiltrate that smuggling operation. And Wolf Mankiewicz, the screenwriter for Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, also wrote a treatment for Dr. No in 1961. He's uncredited with that. And he wrote the screenplay for the non-Eon produced Casino Royale in 1967. Now, moving on to my Disney connections, we've got David Kossoff, who was Ernst in the film. He also appears in 1979's Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color film, The Omega Connection. Glenn Beck, not the former Fox News host, is uncredited as a member of the Young Blood in Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll.
Thanks for pointing that out. Later, because I was confused there for a second. I really thought.
Well, Glenn Beck later in his career played Abraham Lincoln in the 2007 Disney film National Treasure Book of Secrets. Now, the second gambler, played by Walter Gothel, was
played by who?
Walter Gothel.
Gothel?
He was in 64's The Ballad of Hector, the Stowaway Dog, Where the Heck is Hector, as Benton, and in 1979's The Omega Connection as Simmons, both of which were featured on the Walt Disney World of Color program.
That may be the greatest subtitle ever. Colon, Where the Heck is Hector?
That's awesome. I have to ask, Scott, when you rattle off these like Disney World of Disney shows, have you seen all of these?
I've seen some of them. I have not seen Where the Heck is Hector, though. I kind of want to with that subtitle.
Yeah.
Next, we have Doug Robinson, the boxer in The Two Faces. He appeared in several Disney-related films as an actor and a stuntman. He's a snow trooper and stuntman in 1980's The Empire Strikes Back, and did stunts in 1984's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and 1988's Willow. Now, going off the grid here for a second, I have a special connection just for Derek.
Okay, wait. I'm looking forward to it, but is Willow part of the Disney?
Lucasfilm. Lucasfilm.
Is it owned by Lucasfilm flat out?
Part of it. Yeah, I'm not sure the full, but I know it was made by Lucasfilm.
Yeah, yeah. All right, what's my connection? I'm ready.
John Bonney, who was Renfrew in The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, is also the narrator in the 1990 TV miniseries Ultraman Towards the Future.
Oh, yeah.
I knew you would appreciate that one.
Love me some Ultraman. So good. And I think Ultraman Towards the Future was actually the series they did in Australia. Yeah, it's the Australian take, which I think is still kind of sort of part of the, you know what, I could go on and on.
But this is not the Ultraman cast.
There should be an Ultraman podcast.
I'm sure there is.
If there isn't, somebody do it, because I want to and I don't have time. But do it the way I would do it, so I feel like I'm involved.
And then to wrap up my connections, and thanks to Don Falkos, we have our Doctor Who connections.
My favorite part, because I listen to Scott struggle with his pronunciation. I know people give him a hard time. It makes me warm inside.
Okay, we're going to start off with Robert Louis Stevenson.
Oh, come on. Mispronounce that one just for me.
What's Robert Louis Stevenson.
Sounded like you just turned into Dr. Jekyll there for a second.
Yes.
Well, he's the author of the original novella, Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That was the inspiration for this film. In Doctor Who audio adventure, The Fall of the House of Pollard, there is a character named Richard Pollard who reads Stevenson books. Also, the second Doctor gave somebody a copy of Stevenson's Kidnapped in the Doctor Who novel Visiting Hours. Christopher Lee, Paul Allen, in addition to the rather tenuous Doctor Who connections mentioned in two previous Downplace episodes, 49 and 52, there are two other rather tenuous Doctor Who connections for the great Lee. In the Doctor Who novel The Force of the Enemy, it is stated that Christopher Lee played evil fictional characters who thanked other evil characters for doing his work for him. In The Eye of Gorgon, an episode of the Sarah Jane Adventures, a spinoff of Doctor Who, we are reminded that Christopher Lee and Barbara Shelley appeared in a film about Gorgons. Francis DeWolf, the inspector, appeared as Vassar in The Keys of Marinus in Argomenion. There, I messed something up for you.
Yes, you know, we should make a drinking game out of that. Although it's like early for me, but still, I don't care.
In The Mythmakers. Glenn Beck, again, not the Fox commentator, played...
Oh, okay, good, because I was confused there again.
He played the TV announcer in The Tenth Planet. Dennis Cleary, a waiter in the film, played a peasant in The Reign of Terror. Roy Denton, a businessman in the film, uncredited, plays an uncredited role in The Unearthly Child, The Invasion, and Doctor Who in The Similarians. Clifford Earle... appeared as a station sergeant in the Daleks' Master Plan and Major Branwell in The Invasion. Anthony Jacobs, the third gambler uncredited, played Doc Holliday in The Gunfighters. John Moore, an officer uncredited, and Don says he was not able to verify whether or not it's the same John Moore who played Professor Vanderlyn in the Doctor Who stage play The Curse of the Daleks. And Oliver Reed, tough, uncredited. There's a very tenuous Doctor Who connection to Oliver Reed that was mentioned in the 1951 Downplace episode number 52. So that's my connections for the two faces of Dr. Jekyll. There's another one for you. And big thanks to Don Falkos once again for the Doctor Who connections.
Thank you, Don, for doing that bit of legwork. But again, I still think it might be easier if people just said this guy was not involved in Bond, Disney, or Who. Make that segment like 15 seconds long.
Yes, but I probably wouldn't mispronounce near as much.
That's true. Do we want to say anything else about the movie before we get into talking about it? We want to give Scott a break because he's doing the plot synopsis this time. Casey, you have anything you want to add?
Not particularly. It's an interesting movie. It's not one that's going to necessarily upset my list at the end of it, but I could say that I actually enjoyed this quite a bit.
I found some of it kind of disjointed, and I wonder if some of that came from both the pre-production and the post-production. At this time, Hammer is very aware of the film board and is doing their best to not have to compromise their original vision and do what they can to make sure their movies make money while still meeting the needs of the film boards. And I'm reading here, there's a letter that Michael Carreras sent the film people, kind of predating or preempting their look at the final cut of the film so that they know that they've been making changes and listening to them, because apparently they went back and forth a few times. And I'm not going to read through the whole list, because this whole letter, it's got like 15, 16 different points. But this caught my attention. The montage. Again, I think you will find that great discretion has been used. Almost too much, I fear, and then underlined. The black mass, cockfighting, dwarf and bull mastiff have all been deleted. Where the hell would that have been in the movie?
Probably in the montage of the places that Paul Allen took Mr. Hyde when he was wanting to see the seedier sides of London.
Oh, you know, and the cockfighting and all that gambling debt. Okay, there we go. Dwarf and bull mastiff? I don't know what they were doing.
Was the dwarf
riding? I'm just leaving that hanging.
was the dwarf riding the bull mastiff?
I have no idea. Apparently, sounds there was kinky. Also another. Say that again.
I said, sounds kinky.
Kind of like the second Python dance sequence that had to be removed as well.
Ooh, that's
I know,
a shame.
Right? I know. Yeah, I mean, some of the things that they talk about cutting out just seems ridiculous to me.
Well, as much as we talk about the Python dance, there's two dance sequences in this film. That's one and the can-can dance that both could have been trimmed down a little bit to get this movie moving a little quicker pace.
I think we watch a lot of Hammer movies from this era, and they, you know, tend to run like an hour and 15 minutes or so, maybe an hour and 10 a lot of times I've noticed, but this one's actually like an hour and 35. So there's definitely some fluff in here, I think, that could have been cut down, and it probably would have helped with that disjointed feeling that Derek talked about.
Maybe, yeah. I also know they changed the original ending. Do we want to talk about that now, or you want to wait, get through Scott's plot synopsis and we'll mention the ending? What makes more sense?
Might as well wait till we get there.
Yeah, let's just tease that we're going to talk about the original ending.
There was a different ending written, just saying.
Yep, they were all going to commit suicide and jump into the helicopter blades. Wait, that's the wrong movie. Sorry.
When his mom called and said, well, the squirrels are back.
And the dad said, this time it's personal.
Are you in a Zumba class? It's loud there.
Oh, wow. Scott, hit us with the plot synopsis, yo.
If you cannot bear to see a man change before your eyes, then shut them for just a few seconds, if you can. And listen for the shuddering sounds to end. They mark the evil transformation of Henry Jekyll to his monstrous other self, the cruel, depraved Edward Hyde.
For God's sake, man, don't kill him.
Let me alone, Jekyll. Let me alone.
Jekyll.
Here is the century-old horror classic, filmed as it has never been before, with a cast that takes the living shape of the characters that have enthralled billions of readers all over the world. This is Dr. Jekyll, one man with two faces and a mind split in two.
Will we ever know who we really are? Who are you, Kitty?
Dawn Adams, Rogers as his shameless wife, unaware that her husband was two men, both of them watching her jealously.
I don't deserve you, Kitty.
You don't. I deserve you. I deserve nothing better than you.
Christopher Lee, as the lover who shared her deception and her danger. Here is the cold face of hate and the hot face of passion. And the face of torment.
Where's Henry?
Believe me, your husband is here.
It's 1874 in London, and Dr. Jekyll is working on a theory. His theory that every person is of two minds. One mind follows all the rules of a polite society, and the other follows their base instincts. His colleagues ridicule him and drive him into reclusion. His wife is no longer in love with him, and his eyebrows are out of control.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
So I think I started watching this movie before you two did, and I sent Scott a message and just I said, "Eyebrow Town." He's like, "What is Eyebrow Town?" I was like, "You'll see."
Well, Dr. Jekyll's one friend in the world, Dr. Ernst, visits him trying to bring him out of reclusion. Instead, Jekyll talks about his work and shows Ernst his progress by injecting a serum into a monkey, and the monkey goes crazy in his cage.
Now watch. See? Even in the most primitive of men's forebears, an even more primitive, totally unrestrained energy.
What is this? You have turned a placid, affectionate little animal into a miniature devil.
Within 4 hours, when the drug has worn itself off, he will revert to his former placid self.
Now, before Ernst leaves, Dr. Jekyll's wife, Kitty, enters to tell Jekyll that his friend, Paul Allen, has stopped by. It seems that Paul's debts have been mounting up and he's looking for a handout. I guess being the co-founder of Microsoft doesn't go as far as it used to. Kitty tells Jekyll that he should stop supporting Paul, but Jekyll agrees to help. Kitty and Dr. Ernst both leave Jekyll alone in his lab. No comments about Microsoft? Jekyll ignores his friend and wife and decides he's going to test the serum on himself. It brings out his personality that follows its base instincts and frees himself of the moral constraints of polite society. It also shaves him and trims his eyebrows. He takes the name of Dr. Edward Hyde and heads out on the town. Not knowing where to go, he asks a cabbie to take him to the wildest place in town, and he arrives at the Sphinx Club, where a couple of working girls notice him, and one of them takes him to the dance floor. Things are going well for Hyde until he notices Kitty and Paul Allen cutting a rug in there as well. Hyde tells the lady that he's with off, and then befriends Paul and starts to hit on Kitty. And as I said earlier, I love the drunk Christopher Lee in this scene.
He's great.
Yeah.
Now, Kitty is not interested in Hyde and is upset with Paul and wants to leave the club. Now, while this scene plays out, Oliver Reed shows up with the working girl that Hyde was dancing with. Reed must have been her bodyguard or pimp because he's demanding payment for the dance.
Are you sure, Jenny, that that's him?
He tried to force me, and when I wouldn't, he turned on me like an animal.
Friends of yours, old boy?
Are you going to do something to this young lady, or do I have to teach you to behave like a gentleman?
Go to hell.
That's right. How dare you talk to a gentleman like that, you drunken lout!
Will you take me home, Paul?
Women have no sense of honor. How can I leave my friend here like this?
I'm giving you one more chance. Give the little lady a few sovereigns and there'll be no more said.
Good night, gentlemen all.
I told you to go to hell and take that trollop with you.
Hyde flips out and beats Reed with a metal cup over and over again. The next morning, Hyde makes his move on Kitty, basically saying, "You're already an adulteress, let's have some fun." Kitty rejects him because she's in love with Paul Allen. Hyde leaves as Jekyll starts to try to take back over. Returning to Jekyll, he cuts off Paul, telling him he's not supporting him anymore, and tells Kitty he's going away for a while. After another injection, he returns to Hyde and seeks out Paul and agrees to stake him to £5,000 so Paul can gamble, only if Paul shows Hyde the seedy side of London. Paul takes him to a brass knuckle fight, a bawdy bar, and an opium den. They return to the Sphinx Club, where they catch the show of Maria, a snake charmer who is very intimate with her snake-slash-dancing partner. After the show, Paul tells Hyde that Maria is unobtainable and not to waste his time. Hyde ignores this advice and seduces Maria, as Maria likes direct men and snakes.
Remind me to come back to the snakes.
After spending the night with Maria, Hyde returns to his cold wife and attempts to get with her again, and she again refuses Hyde. Hyde then returns to find Paul Allen has burned through both the £5,000 and the number of wild places he knows in London. Hyde then offers some more money to Paul, only if he can get Kitty to sleep with Hyde. Paul gets a moment of consciousness and refuses the offer. Then Hyde then hatches a plan to get even with everyone and set himself up in the Jekyll house. Hyde delivers a note from Jekyll and invites Kitty and Paul to the club for dinner. How much farther into the ending of this do we want to go? Are we going to spoil the ending?
Well, I don't know if we want to spoil it.
Okay.
That said, I do want to comment on kind of what happens between Hyde and Kitty.
I'll go to the end of that dinner. How's that?
Sure.
So at the club, Paul and Kitty arrive. They are told that Hyde and Jekyll are waiting upstairs in Maria's room. Paul tells Kitty to wait, and he'll go find out what's going on. Up in Maria's room, Hyde tells Paul that Jekyll is in the other room. Paul enters that room to find Maria's snake, a boa constrictor, is loose, and Hyde locks Paul in with it. Hyde then goes downstairs to get Kitty to bring her up to Maria's room. Once there, he throws her on the bed and rips her clothes off as the scene fades to black. Kitty then awakes alone in the room as Hyde has returned to the Jekyll home with Maria. And Kitty opens the room where she finds Paul was locked in and finds the body with the boa slithering on top of it. She then goes out to the balcony where she sits on the rail. She is distraught as her life has fallen apart and the man she loves is dead, and she falls from the rail and crashes into the club below.
Obviously, we need to wrap up the story between Jekyll and Hyde, but I think, I mean, that might have even been given away too much, but yeah, I mean, it's, nobody gets away, man.
No.
No, it's pretty brutal. I mean, there's the rape scene, there's the death by boa. It's pretty tough. And no wonder they went back and forth with censors on some of this, because they had to cut out little things here and there. They had to cut out Hyde shooting up with the serum before the rape scene or after the rape scene. They had to cut out, I mean, the rape scene altogether had to be trimmed extensively. Apparently there was some nudity that had to be cut.
The way it's portrayed in the film, you can convince yourself that it wasn't really a rape, because he just rips parts of her clothes off. And then that's kind of how it ends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Apparently it went a little bit further and they had to trim it. Unless you're really paying attention, I mean, you can, again, like Scott said, I think it's a great way to put it. You can convince yourself that he just aggressively cuddled her. I don't know. Wow.
I'm going to snuggle you.
No!
Well, I think that you could look at that and he degraded her. In such a way of just making her partially, or dressing more, and I hate to use this word, but I can't think of another word, but dressing her more like a slut, like he thinks she is.
Right.
Yeah.
You could think that that's all he did, the way it's presented in the film. And the fact that he knows that she's going to have to walk back through the club dressed like that.
Out of everything, the most disturbing thing about this entire movie is the way that Hyde deals with his own wife. There's just some really gnarly stuff going through that guy's head.
It's obvious, and I'm just going to lump them together, that Jekyll and Hyde love Kitty. They both do. Jekyll doesn't know how to act upon it. He's basically been shamed into being a hermit, and he doesn't know how to be with his wife in a loving way at all. Hyde acts upon that in a more base desire that he just wants to have her. He doesn't love her, he just wants her. And I think that's the difference. I think Jekyll still loves her, just doesn't know how to act upon it.
They make it clear that their relationship with Jekyll and Kitty is not good. She's trying to think of the best way to put this PC. She has no interest in him. She is tied up in her affair, and that's where her mind is. And she knows that Jekyll is, his mind is tied up in his experiments, and he is more interested in that than spending time with her. So she kind of rebukes all of his advances or anything like that whenever he shows any kind of interest. So she knows that it's going to be that there's nothing coming from that side. And you can tell that there's, like with Jekyll, he doesn't know how to deal with that. But when he comes to Hyde, it becomes the very unsavory idea that he's going to take what Jekyll wouldn't.
And the first two times that he tries is when you find out that Kitty is really in love with Paul.
Yeah.
And that's why she doesn't give in to Hyde. I mean, Hyde is of the mind, hey, she's already going out on her husband with one guy. What's another guy? Where's the conflict there? But I think Kitty really loves Paul and tries to run away with him at a couple points in the film. And I don't know why she fell in love with Jekyll in the first place. Maybe he was a lot more outgoing before he was ridiculed and drove into seclusion. But at that point, I think she thinks the world's beat him down and he has no backbone and he doesn't even, you know, show any aggression's not the right word, but any feelings towards her. And she knows she can rebuke him on anything that he does because he's so weak and so meek.
I have not said anything. I've just been sitting here nodding along because I agree with both of you.
Yeah.
That works so well on a podcast.
It does.
Well, it's a topic that really becomes kind of it fits into a lot of stuff that's going on in the news today. A lot of discussions that are going on out there for women's rights and things like that. Okay. It's a counterpoint. That's not the right word. Not counterpoint. But you get what I'm saying. There's a lot of discussion going on around this with women and their rights and consent and things like that. And this really plays off of that in a disturbing way.
I can see a little bit of what Casey's talking about here. There is, you know, there's talk of slut shaming and things like that. And
yeah,
I can see a little bit of that here. A little bit. I mean, not to forgive Kitty for being an adulteress. I mean, clearly that's not necessarily the behavior of a loving wife, but just because she dresses a particular way or just because she does something doesn't mean she's out slutting it around. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't think she ever thinks of herself that way.
No, not at all. But I'm agreeing with what Casey was saying, the comparisons to like some of the conversations that are being had today.
I think she sees herself in a loveless marriage and she's looking for love. I don't think she's looking for the physical with Paul. I mean, she's obviously getting that too, but I think she's more looking for the emotional love.
There's some of that there, yes, but then you get the whole angle of how brazen she is with the affair. She's not hiding it at all.
No, and I go back to Jekyll's not going to find out because he locks himself in his laboratory all day.
Right.
I don't think she's worried about him finding out because he's not interacting with anybody in the public whatsoever. I mean, they could print it on the front page of the paper and I doubt he'd be reading it. I think she's just so comfortable with knowing that she's got a key to the city to do whatever she wants. Her husband's just so meek and so weak. He's not going to, even if he found out about it, she'd be able to handle it.
I see where Scott's coming from. And I do agree on some levels, but I mean, let's, cheating on your husband, whether you're in a loveless marriage or not.
No, I don't.
There are things that you can do to fix that, you know?
Yes, but she's also, you got to look at the era that she's in too. And divorce was actually, you know, in that kind of era, especially in London and society and the way culture and everything was there, divorce might be seen as more damaging to her than Anna Faris would.
Good point.
And I also think that Paul is using her in such a way that even if this was happening today and she would go for a divorce, she may not be entitled to a 50-50 split because she's the one having the affair. That's going to cut Paul's revenue stream off.
Yeah, it's true. It gets complicated.
And I think Paul is basically telling Kitty, let's just stay with what we've got because Jekyll is supporting both of our lifestyles right now.
Yeah, because that's another angle that makes all this even more slimy is because Paul is taking such obvious advantage of her, too.
Yeah, we find out that Paul is a heavy gambler, and he blows through 5,000 pounds in a week. So he needs that income that Jekyll is providing, and he doesn't want Kitty to leave and lose that money, lose access to it. He's happy with the way things are. He's got his money, and he's got his honey, so...
Yeah, he's very much using her, which makes him a great villain for the movie.
Yeah.
Because you could say that even in both forms, as Jekyll and Hyde, he's not necessarily the villain in this.
I think he is a little bit as Hyde, but not near as much as Paul.
Right. And Paul's the true, like, supervillain of the movie, to me. And while Hyde is not an angel or anything by any means, he's more of a product of Paul's villainy.
And for that reason, I can see why Christopher Lee enjoyed playing this role after he got over his initial disappointment of not playing the Jekyll Hyde character. Because his role is very important in this film to bring out everybody else.
Yep.
Are you nodding again, Derek?
I am. No, this is just a fascinating conversation that I didn't want to interrupt this time. No, I mean, this is what I love about, you know, some of these movies, especially these older movies, you can kind of look at and you see all these things that you can kind of read into it. You're given all these clues and all these little character cues and elements that you can kind of build from and have these conversations and kind of see what's really happening here. And I love it. You know, you watch a modern movie and it's so kind of on the nose. You know, it's right there in your face. I like this one and I like movies like this for that reason. I still think this movie's got a lot of problems. I think this movie still feels disjointed. I feel like Terrence Fisher was not the right guy to direct the screenplay. I as much as I love Fisher, I think this movie's got a lot of issues, but there are a lot of things to really enjoy and dive in. Most of them are surrounding Chris Farley, but there's a lot to really enjoy and just kind of savor, and that's what I was doing there for a second. I know, great podcasting, I know.
I didn't really have any problems with this feeling disjointed. I really kind of enjoyed this overall, and I like the different take they took on the whole monster angle and everything, so I was kind of wrapped up on that. And I'm not saying the movie's perfect, but I think it helped gloss the fact that I got wrapped up in the angle they went with Hyde and did it differently than what you would expect for Hyde. It really kind of sucked me in, so it kind of helped gloss over any problems with feeling disjointed for me.
Yeah, I didn't have that disjointed feeling either. I agree with Casey. I like the take that they did. I will say that the film drug on in a couple spots. Those, like I said earlier, the dance sequences could have been trimmed. I also, the ending disappointed me because I don't feel it's as a solid resolution to the Hyde Jekyll story as there is a satisfying conclusion to the rest of the stories.
In the very ending of this, without spoiling it, they kind of tack on an extra bit after everything comes to conclusion. It feels like there's an extra bit that's tacked on. I think that could have been excised completely.
You're talking about the Inquisition?
No.
Yes.
I'm talking about even after that, the way that it's resolved. I don't mind the Inquisition. That makes perfect sense in the way that the story was going. How neatly it's wrapped up at the end with the way it happens, and I can't really say more without spoiling it, it didn't feel satisfying to me. It's like all of a sudden, okay, we turned a switch, the light's off.
Yeah.
Well, can I read what is not the ending?
No.
So we're not spoiling anything, and I'm editing it, so I'm going to say yes, I can. This comes from Hammer's film Legacy, from Quatermass to The Devil's Daughter by Wayne Kinsey. In the far distance, we see a man on the gallows. We move in very fast till we are close to the face of Jekyll. The trap swings away. The body jerks as the rope tautens. Slowly, the body resolves away. As the body again swings into the camera, we now see the dead face of Hyde.
I read that as well. I would like to have had the characters reversed. That it starts off as Hyde, the evil, were
goes to Jekyll.
And goes to Jekyll. Because Jekyll, to me, seems, I mean, yeah, he invented the serum, but he almost, you know, Hyde was the evil one taking over. He was the one that should have been punished, not Jekyll as much. And then when you see there at the end, they're trying to punish Hyde, but they really punish Jekyll, would have been a much more powerful
ending. Yeah, because you got to remember, Jekyll didn't invent the serum for evil purposes. Jekyll invented this serum to help mute children.
Yeah.
And also to study his theory of that there's two separate personalities in everybody.
Right. But it was kind of like helping the children, because there's a whole thing. We didn't really discuss it much, but I mean, the movie starts out with Jekyll. He's inviting these mute children from a home or something over to his place, and they sit and play, and they talk about how much the kids enjoy coming over there and how much they enjoy him and everything. And he's trying to help them, and he's got a whole little monologue about how he's trying to help them unlock the other side of him that will be more vocal and everything.
There you are. In each one of these dumb human animals, there is a personality which shows itself only in play.
Dumb human animals? Henry, these are not pretty guinea pigs. They are children who cannot speak.
But I am convinced that in this case, the not speaking is a refusal of one part of the mind to allow the other part to express itself freely.
You suggest they play out what they cannot speak out.
Precisely.
You're the same Henry Jekyll, forever seeking keys to the locked doors of the mind.
To me, it always came across that Jekyll had good intentions, and that's what makes him a little more tragic in the end of this. That as it went, he started to break down and he couldn't handle it anymore. Because they also talk about how the doctor thinks he's got a drug addiction, and it's like he's burning the candle at both ends. So it's kind of the whole process is wearing him down, so he's kind of falling victim to it all. Not to mention the whole alter ego of him coming out. It's affecting both him physically and mentally. So I would agree with Scott that if they, you know, in that alternate ending, if it would have finished on Jekyll, it would have been a little more tragic.
Either way, I think that ending would have been a little bit more of a gut punch than what we ended up with.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. When I say I felt like the movie was disjointed, I do feel like there, I mean, it's already a longer movie, but I feel like it could have been longer in some spots and trimmed up a lot more in others. And maybe I'm responding to a lot of the cuts that had to be made due to the censors. But to me, it does feel like there's a little bit of choppiness here and there that could have been cleaned up a little bit. And I get it. And I know why they did it. And I also realize it's probably a throwback to the original novel, even though I haven't read it in years. The usage of writing in a journal for narrative purposes, for writing in a diary to give the character something to say without having to have another character in the scene for him to say it too. And I felt like it was overused in this one, in this movie, a lot. And I know it's hard to act by yourself. I mean, that's why they gave a volleyball to Tom Hanks in Castaway. I get it. But it just felt like a lot in this. Does that make sense? Or am I alone in that?
I liked the method of the journal keeping, because it seemed to me that that would be what a scientist, especially a recluse scientist, would do. So I didn't feel it was a drag on the film.
Yeah.
I just felt like it was too much. I don't think getting rid of it altogether, but I think it felt like it was too much. I don't know. But I did like that they made sure that we saw that he blotted the extra ink away before turning the page. I thought that was a nice little touch.
Yeah.
That felt like something Cushing would do.
That's true.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back to the snake real quick, just because there was a one of the cuts that had to be made from the ratings board, from the censor people. Shorten Maria's snake dance. Shots that must be removed are A, those where the snake is between her legs, B, those where she puts the snake in her mouth.
Those were both on the version I watched.
Yeah, I know. Apparently, well, it had to be shortened, so apparently it was a little bit more, I don't know, it snaked out a little bit longer in the original, the final. I don't know. I have a feeling I'm a little bit colder on this movie than you guys are, and I feel like, based on what I've read here, the various distributors were as well. It ended up being distributed by American International, and they're the ones that came up with some of those alternate titles that we mentioned at the top of this. But it wasn't originally going to go to American International. I believe it was Columbia that was going to pick it up, and they're like, yeah, let's put it over here instead. And it bounced around a couple of places and finally ended up going to American International. Didn't do very well.
Yeah, Wikipedia says the film lost Hammer an estimated 30,000 pounds.
Well, it also went over budget, which is not good, especially for which is not good, which isn't good for a studio that's known for being frugal. Yeah, I lost him some money. And maybe there is some truth to the idea that Fisher was asked to hold off for a little while somebody else directed the next vampire film for them. Because this one, and then The Curse of the Werewolf, was in production when this one premiered. And again, that one didn't do too very well either, theatrically. Which is too bad, because that one's a fantastic film.
I think this one's one of their better films. Enjoyable. I mean, it's a different take. It's a different type of monster movie, because it's all psychological. And I kind of enjoyed that. I mean, you don't see a Frankenstein or a werewolf or something. You don't, you know, what you see as the evil, what you think is going to be the evil when you start watching the film, Mr. Hyde, really, yeah, he's evil, but he's not the main evil in the film. As we said earlier, the villain is more Christopher Lee.
Yep.
And I really like that, I don't want to say misdirection, but just difference compared to most Hammer Gothic films.
Yeah, and I mean, with that in mind, I'd sort of, same reason I like this a lot too. And it's more of a, where usually we see Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde presented in a monster type category, this is more of a psychological thriller. So I kind of really enjoyed that spin on it.
You can talk about what you see in this film or whatever. All I see is a fake beard and eyebrows. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, that beard is a little rough, but you know.
I did not. And again, this is maybe where I struggle with this movie, is I'm used to the people that were involved giving us nothing but excellence. Roy Ashton, the legendary Hammer makeup guy, did the makeup for Jekyll, and I felt like it just didn't work. And maybe it's because I'm watching it on an HD TV. I don't know. Maybe it looked better.
If they would have gone just with the beard and stash, it's the eyebrows that is over the top.
Yeah.
He felt kind of like one of the Geico cavemen to me.
I could see that.
You know, doing what they did to the brows just kind of makes his brow overall just look heavy. He looks a little Neanderthal-y.
Yeah, if they could have just left the longer hair and the beard, I think they would have been better.
Well, even then, though, they have some close-ups of the beard, and it's just obviously applied and not natural.
But it's interesting, because that's also goes to my point on how they've changed things around on the monster aspect. Usually we see Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Mr. Hyde's the one that's got the kind of Neanderthal brow and the crazy beard. So this was reversed.
Have either one of you seen the Christopher Lee film I mentioned earlier, I, Monster?
Yes.
No, I
haven't. Yeah, because in that, Lee, as the Hyde character, he is an ugly son of a bitch.
Right.
Well, I will say this one thing. I'd much prefer the way they did it than doing two actors. Because I think Paul Massey acts so differently when he's one or the other character, even if he looks like Hyde, but Jekyll is taking over, you can tell. He plays it, each one of them, so differently that it's easy to tell who's in control.
Yeah, his smile, that's what really sets him apart when he becomes Mr. Hyde. He's got a great, almost Joker-like smile.
Yeah.
It's pretty fantastic. And that also goes back to just with that notion that Scott's bringing up. That's the other thing I liked about the journal part of it. They show a scene later on in the end when Hyde reasserts himself on his own without the serum, and you see the handwriting change. I thought that was fantastic.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Point Scott and Casey. No, the look in his face as Hyde, I loved. The look in his eyes, the way I just loved how he looked. I mean, he did a really good job. As Jekyll, I felt like it was a little over the top, but maybe that was because he had to work through those fake eyebrows and everything else.
That and slowing his voice down.
Yes.
But I also thought when he was Jekyll, there was a lost look in his eyes that sold it to me. That he didn't know how to act. He didn't know what to do. That's what sold me as Jekyll. I was able to look past the bad makeup and see the performance of Paul Massey as Jekyll. That's what sold me on Jekyll.
Yeah. I thought Paul Massey was pretty great.
I did too.
Right on. Do we want to talk top fives? Does this break into a top five for anybody?
This would be in my top five Jekyll and Hyde Hammer films.
I was going to go there.
It'd be in my top three, actually.
You've seen three, right?
Well, I know they made three. I haven't seen the other two.
So, and Casey?
It's not going to break my top five, but this is definitely, I hadn't seen this one before, so this is definitely a Hammer flick I'm going to revisit. I enjoyed it a lot.
Really? Wow. Okay. I'm kind of lukewarm on it, or at least colder on it than Scott and Casey. I did like elements of it, but yeah, it's lower on the totem pole for me. So that is The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, which I saw in my four-pack of Icons of Horror on DVD.
Which is currently available on Amazon for $16.04. It's also available in the Hammer Films Volume 1 collection, which has The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, Scream of Fear, The Gorgon, Stop Me Before I Kill, and The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, and it's only $8.99 right now.
Oh, wow.
So they're both currently available on Amazon. As Derek was saying, the Icon of Horror collection is a four-pack with Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, Scream of Fear, Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, and The Gorgon.
I'm trying to look up the other movie this was released with as part of a double feature. It was something called Green Mare's Nest, and I can't find anything on it. Uh-oh. Everybody there?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, okay.
I've never heard of that film.
Yeah, and I'm not finding it any either, but it makes me wonder if it was even a horror film. Anyway, yeah, that's the movie. All right, do we have any feedback from previous episodes on your side? Because I've got something here.
I do not have anything.
Okay. Casey?
Nope.
Okay, so I have a post that was left on my Facebook page from Deborah Delvecchio. And Deborah, maybe I'm mispronouncing your name. We've been saying it Delvecchio. Is it Delvecchio maybe? I don't know. So Deborah, I apologize. But she is one of the co-authors of Hammer Films, An Exhaustive Filmography. And I thought it was kind of cool that she listens to the show. And then she had a comment about episode number 50, which was Scott's birthday pick month, Phantom Ship. And I wanted to share this. People who follow me on Facebook already saw this. And I did tag Scott and Casey as well, but thought I'd share it on the show. Listen to your podcast about the Phantom Ship. And while it was quite enjoyable, I was shocked when one of you, not sure whose voice it was, said that Tilly Day was a he. Tilly was the continuity gal at Hammer for umpteenth years, and during the filming of Mary Celeste, she recalled that Bela referred to her as the English Rose, and even made a pass at her. Shame on you for not reading that in our book, Hammer Films and Exhaustive Filmography. Keep up the good work, guys, even though I also disagree with you on your assessment of Noel Wellman's performance in Kiss of the Vampire. And ... smiley face, winky face, emojis. And I'm going to say it was probably one of you two that said that about Tilly Day, because clearly I would not make a mistake.
I'm sure it was me.
No, you would have mispronounced it.
It's not Tally.
The L's silent.
Scott referred to her as Tilly Knight. So.
Oh, I see. Actually, I'm going to blame Scott Baio.
Yep.
It's Chachi's fault.
Exactly. Joni loves Chachi, but no longer the rest of us.
So I thought that was kind of cool. So thank you for sending that message to us and publicly posting on my Facebook wall about how we screwed up. That was nice. Well, if people want to get a hold of us, they can leave a message on Facebook, but we have a couple of other ways to do so as well.
They can call us at area code 765-203-1951. Of course, the 1951 is reference to the name of the podcast.
Wow. Mind blown.
They can also send us email at podcast@1951downplace.com. We can also be found on Facebook. We have both a group and a page. Just search for 1951 Downplace there. And we have a Twitter account at 1951 Downplace.
As of this recording, our Facebook page currently has 240 likes. So if you are a Facebook user, consider giving us a like. We'd like you back or something. next week, what are we talking about next week?
Next week?
Yeah. Listeners, we are kind of off our game because we're recording really early in the month. In fact, we are recording on Andrew Keir's birthday.
Happy birthday, Andrew.
Yeah.
If you're listening.
I'd like to think that all the Hammer stars that have left us are sitting around in some sort of Hammer afterlife being entertained by Maria the Snake Dancer listening to 1951 Down Place.
They probably, you know, being in the afterlife can listen to us live. They're probably hearing the raw feed.
I hope that's not the case because I'm just saying.
Their podcasting equipment is that good.
So, yeah, we're recording early, I guess is what I was saying. So, yeah, I was just excusing myself for making a blunder there. Next month on Monster Kid Radio, we are on Monster Kid Radio. What the hell?
Ladies and gentlemen, next month on 1951 Down Place, we are going to be talking about The Reptile.
In this remote little country village, the mortal remains of a man are laid to rest.
Who is it this time, Peter?
It's Mr. Spaulding. They found him this morning. Just like the others.
Just like the others, he died in the night.
Get away from there! Get away!
Suddenly, violently, horribly.
This is an evil place. Corrupt and evil.
Evil, as venomous as a snake, turns the quiet of this village into a writhing hell on earth, where every man fears for his safety and his sanity, where everyone is suspect.
What do you mean they died by some sort of magic, some witchcraft?
For the first time in my life, I'm frightened.
Everyone is frightened. The doctor who'd lived his life in the East. This man who could be the next victim. This woman and this girl are frightened, hypnotized by the crawling, creeping spell of the reptile.
Stop! Pack your things, we're leaving.
No, Dr. Franklin. You are not leaving.
I could kill you.
Possibly. But you could never be free then, could you? And what would happen to little Anna then?
Trapped like animals in a cage and getting closer and closer, suffocating them with terror. The reptile.
Are you sure? Apparently I'm not.
I have no idea what will be on next week on Monster Kid Radio.
Will there be more snake dancing in the reptile?
You know, there. I don't... Have you not seen the reptile? Have either of you seen the reptile?
I haven't.
It's an hour and a half, so it's a longer one. It's directed by John Gilling. I didn't wait for Scott to answer. Go ahead.
No, I have not seen The Reptile.
Well, Noel Willman's in that one, too.
I always get confused when I see the poster. I get confused this one and The Gorgon.
You know, it's... Yeah, they... Mm-hmm. Yes.
Michael Ripper's in it.
Yeah, no, The Reptile, I remember, I haven't seen it in a while, so I'm looking forward to revisiting it. I think it's kind of cool. It's one of the ones that was shot at Bray during their push to do a whole bunch all at once. So this one, Plague of the Zombies, Rescue and the Mad Monk, were all kind of done around the same time.
Yeah,
The
Reptile's from 1966.
Mm-hmm. Looking forward to that. So come back next month for that episode.
Yes. Please.
Don't make Scott beg.
And if you want to see our entire list of films that we've covered and what's coming up, you can head over to our website at 1951downplace.com. And across the top, you will find a link called Episode List. Just click there and you can see all the way back to September 2011, our Episode 1, Horror of Dracula.
Holy cats. When we hit September, does that mean we've been doing this for 5 years?
Yes, sir.
Wow. I'm trying real hard to come up with a joke to make here, but I got nothing. I'm just, wow. You think we can keep the podcast going longer than Hammer Films was in existence?
I don't know. At some point, we're going to run out of Hammer Films. So. Especially if you make us go weekly.
Well, we're not going to run out for a while. There's still quite a few out there we'll cover. All right. Are we done?
I think so.
So until next month, check us, our individual podcast. Make sure you check out Monster Kid Radio with Derek. Check out Bloody Good Horror, Cinema Fromage, or whatever else that that Casey wants to put out. And you can check me and my wife out over at DisneyIndiana.com.
I don't want to see what Casey's putting
out. Well, it involves snakes now.
Now we're back to slut shaming. Bloody Good Horror. Is the Instamatic up and running again?
It is. Okay. It's Instamatic's monthly. It is part of, you have to be a Bloody Good Horror patron to get a hold of it. But yes, we are out there. You can definitely check that out. Cinema Fromage is on a bit of a hiatus, but it'll be back here soon.
Right on.
So a whole bunch of good podness, a whole bunch of podcast goodness to stick in your ears.
1951 Town Place, your home for Hammer Films podness.
And Wolf Mankiewicz.
You know, there's a picture of Wolf in the Hammer Films book that I was referencing earlier, The Hammer Story. He's incredibly clean-shaven and looks rather un-wolf-like.
Well, that's a shame.
That's, I know, disappointing. So,
I know, right? I'm going to envision him with the fake beard and mustache and everything.
I'm envisioning him more like, you know, there's Wolf Cop. He's Wolf Screenwriter. He's actual werewolf writing this stuff out.
I'm going to end on Scott just making himself laugh like that. I'm just going to let it go on and on. I'll probably loop it a few times.
I guess I followed Nick Brown too much.
just letting Scott giggle on the way out repeatedly. All right. Good podness, everybody.
Alrighty.
This is the still going.
And a good podness to you. A good podness, everyone.